Welcome to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. All right, Greg, you ready to get into this?
I sure am.
Okay, let's start with a question from Joel. I have the problem of evil sorted in my mind, but what about animal suffering? Why would God create animals and allow so much suffering and gruesome deaths?
Well, this is an issue that was brought up to me by a young earther who made the claim that there's animal suffering and how could God possibly countenance such a thing as entailed by an old earth perspective. And I get my response there. I can't promise that I'm going to give an answer that's going to be fully adequate for everyone, but oftentimes we don't see the big picture in these things. And in everything, there is a trade-off. Okay? So some people, here's a parallel, an analogy that I want to use to get into making this point. Some people have complained that, you know, if God really designed things, he could have done a better job at designing them. Okay? Because, look, this thing doesn't work very well to accomplish this purpose they have in mind. But when you design something for a purpose, it does not serve other purposes well. Okay? So an automobile is highly designed, but you're not going to be able to drive it across the river because it's not a boat. A boat is designed wonderfully, but you're not going to be able to drive it down the freeway because that's not what it's made for. The point I'm making is there are always certain trade-offs. We have to think what the purposes were. Now, when I was pressed on this issue by this man, I asked him if he thought that God designed creatures to feel pain. And he had to think about it for a second, but then he said, I think he said yes, or maybe I asked the question from a different perspective, and I said, do you think that pain has a useful function in an organism's life? Okay, so both of those going together, the point is pain is actually serves a good function, physical pain, a good function, and the good function is to warn us of danger. So we put our hand on something hot, we feel pain, we pull it back so we don't get injured by the heat. And there's a whole bunch of examples like that, but I think that's adequate to make the point. Now, of course, if a creature cannot escape the heat, like in a forest fire or something like that, then that creature is going to die a painful death. And there's no way to avoid that, because the thing that is made for a good purpose also it serves a good purpose, but at the same time, it is inadequate in other ways. I don't know how else to put it, okay? And it's going to be the case for virtually everything you could imagine that has a design function, that there's going to be a downside to that in some way. I guess what I want to say is, in God's wisdom, he made a world that worked well, even though this means there was going to be the possibility of excess in some areas, not just the possibility, the eventuality of it. And I guess what we end up doing, I think, is somewhat anthropomorphizing some of these things. Well, I wouldn't want to feel the pain that that animal is feeling, and that's terrible, and therefore it would be wrong if I felt it, and it would be wrong for the animal to feel it. I guess I'm not sympathetic to that way of thinking. I think it's an emotional reaction, all right? God designed the world in a particular way, and just because it has some liabilities doesn't mean the design wasn't good, because I don't consider pain to be bad in general. I will say this, though, and this is something a lot people who have not spent time in the wild or with creatures may not have noticed. But a lot of animals go torpid when they start feeling a lot of pain. In other words, they just kind of go inert. And it appears when they're in a difficult circumstance, and I've been in circumstances to see this, not only on film, but also, I mean, watching something like, you know, in the wild in Africa and stuff, but also, you know, in just my own experience, that when an animal is injured or is approaching death, they seem to settle down and relax into it, almost as if the pain ceases to be a factor. Now, I'm not in their head, so I don't know what they're actually feeling. But after the fight or flight thing is resolved in a circumstance where they're not going to get away, they just seem to collapse. Now, there may be something that's going on there in their central nervous system that God has also designed that makes it easier for them, less painful, to succumb to the attack. And I mean, let's face it, hardly anything dies a natural death, it seems to me. You know, when you get carnivores around, you know, it's just the way God made the world. It is obvious to me that death entails design features in the animal kingdom. In fact, I was on the road jogging once in Colorado Springs. I was at Summit, had some time off. I was jogging down a trail, and then I saw a carcass of a rabbit, and it looked totally dead and half gone, but it was moving. I couldn't figure out why it was moving. It caught my attention, so I looked closely, and the illusion of motion was all the variety of different critters that were feasting on this carcass as God's disposal system. I guarantee you, in a day or so, that carcass would be gone. And there were probably six or seven different types of insects or whatever that were involved in the process. All of them designed to eat carrion and to remove and kind of recycle the carcass of this dead animal. Now, that is unmistakably a design feature. All right? And if it's a design feature, God designed it. I think I wrote a piece a long time ago, or I did a commentary on when I was in KBRT back in the early days when I was doing regular radio, called Design for Death. And I was just making the case that God is involved in designing everything in a very particular way with animal death, at least, in mind and in view, and had built this great system into the ecosystem in a very balanced and intentional fashion, okay? So I'm actually going beyond the original question, but I think these are all tied together, okay? Do animals get terrified when they face the possibility of being eaten by a predator? Of course they do, because the terrified feeling creates in them an impulse to flee. Okay? And that's just the way that works. We feel the same thing, get terrified emotionally because of danger. And then we want to protect ourselves from the danger. It's the way that God has designed us to protect ourselves. So it is a design feature that has a good purpose in God's economy, but also has I don't know if I want to call it a side effect or what, but it has this other side to it. And I don't think that other side in this particular case is a result of the fall. I have no reason to believe that.
So, Greg, just even if you're wrong about that, even if the death is a result of the fall, I think there still are reasons for it. I mean, first of all, if you have figured out, as Joel says, if you figured out how to deal with human evil and suffering, I'm not sure why this would be any different, because he says he's already dealt with that. So what? But why would he do this to animals? But the answer is the same reason why we're fallen in Adam, right? The whole world is fallen because of Adam. And so because of that, the animals suffer for that. We suffer for that. Everything in this universe suffers for that, that can suffer. And there's decay and there's all these other things. So the idea that maybe they're innocent, so why did God do this? But the truth is, because Adam was the head of the world and he was head over the animals, they also fell. And that's the way that God has done this. So why did God create animals? I think there's a lot of purposes for animals. You know, beyond even just their help for us, they're creative and they're beautiful and they're interesting. And
they taste good.
we eat them. But they're in a fallen world. I think even the suffering of animals has a purpose in terms, a theological purpose. When we see this death and suffering, and of course God knew there would be a fall, even if you think, yes, that all the animals were created to have this cycle of they're eating each other, whatever it is. When we see that destruction, we are also reminded of sin. It's a picture of sin. Every time we see suffering, every time we see evil, it's a picture of the ugliness of our own sin. It's a result of our sin, and it's an image of our sin. And when we, I think of one time, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show before, but I feel like maybe I did recently, but I saw this video of a sacrifice in Israel that someone had done of a lamb. And it was very difficult to watch because all you can think is, here is this poor innocent lamb who's dying because of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's the point.
Right.
That is exactly what it's there for, so that we can recognize what it means for our sin to kill someone who is innocent. It's all a picture helping us to see who Jesus is and what he's done. So I think all of these things play into this. And the same questions we have about suffering for human beings is the same question we have to answer for suffering for animals. And I'd also like to point out that I think there's a difference between pain and suffering where human beings suffer in a way that animals can't. The animals can feel pain, but the animals can't perceive evil. There's no evil being done when an animal eats another animal. It's not like a serial killer who tortures a human being, and the human being has understanding of what's happening and mm-hmm. understanding of the evil, and they can perceive that. There's a level of suffering that human beings endure that animals don't endure. So be careful not to put those ideas onto the animals and what they're experiencing.
And that has to do with, at least arguably, cognitive ability. Now that you mention this, I remember either J.P. Moreland or Bill Craig talking about this once. I think it was J.P. And he was saying animals, here's what the way he put it. Now, people can accept it or reject it, and he could probably defend it better than I can. I can't even defend it. I'll tell you what he said. He says, animals feel pain, but they don't know that the pain is theirs. They are not self-reflective on the pain, all right? And so that represents a cognitive difference between animal pain and human suffering that may be akin to what you're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a whole extra level that human beings have to endure with those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go on to a question from Matchless M. Recently, I heard reports of Christian teenage girls being kidnapped by Islamic terrorists. Some might argue that we should be content no matter what. Should these girls and other Christians fight back or accept their circumstances?
Well, I mean, I see no theological reason why people should not fight back and seek their freedom under these circumstances or any circumstance where freedom is being impinged on in less extreme forms than what you just described. There are a number of places in Scripture, I'm thinking in the New Testament, in the Gospels, and also in the Book of Acts, where persecution reared its head and people fled. Okay, I mean, the earliest case is Jesus right after he was born, and there was Herod ready to kill the newborns in Bethlehem, and Joseph fled with his family to Egypt on the urging of an angel in a vision or a dream. So there was persecution. Flee, okay? It wasn't like, well, this is fate, just take it. I think the idea, and then you also have Paul being persecuted early on in the book of Acts, and he's in Damascus, and they let him over the wall in a basket so he can get out of there. And there's a number of other cases in Asia Minor, etc., when a riot happens, and they flee, to the next. In fact, Jesus says that, I think, in Matthew 10, if they persecute you in one city, flee to the next, something to that effect. Now, this to me is an example of harm that is on the horizon for a person, and this one in these cases due to spiritual things, but nevertheless harm, that they are encouraged to flee. So there seems to me there's no theological reason of any kind to simply surrender to whatever happens to you. We are to take responsible action with regards to our families, etc., etc., and try to oppose the evil of losing our liberties and other evils that follow from having lost the liberty, like sexual predation in this case. Now, if it turns out that there is nothing we can do on our own to change the circumstances, then in the midst of terrible circumstances, we trust God. If Corrie ten Boom could have escaped from the concentration camp, Mauthausen, or wherever she was at, then she should have done that. And in fact, before that, she did all kinds of things to avoid detection, breaking all kinds of laws, not just hiding Jews. There were all kinds of laws she broke, falsifying documentation and stuff like that, food coupons, etc. And so she worked hard to avoid that when she was stuck there, and she couldn't avoid it any longer. That was the opportunity to trust that God would work in a difficult circumstance. And I think that's the equation there. We do what we can. And when we can't do any more that's appropriate in the circumstance, then we have to simply trust God for the outcome. Let me make a different kind of application of this. Some people are in relationships, committed relationships that are really bad for whatever reason. They're painful. They're difficult. And they have done everything they can to improve on the circumstances and have not been able to do it. Some parents have children that are rebellious and just won't respond to their direction. What do you do? You can do what you can do, and that's all. Sometimes you run the limit. And when you run the limit, this is where you have to trust God to accomplish what you are not able to accomplish. And by the way, it doesn't mean he's going to do that. But it means that it's now within his province. We do what we can do. Here, Romans, 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there. If possible, as far as it's within your power, be at peace with all men. Okay? So that means it's not always going to be possible, and it's not always going to be within your power. And so if you are not at peace in a relational circumstance, whatever that looks like, then this is where, and you can't do anything about it, then this is where you're going to have to trust God. And this is where prayer comes in powerfully. That's God's side of the equation, you know, and this is where we appeal to him aggressively to act.
Mm-hmm. I think of Philippians. I'm always thinking of Romans, but I think of Philippians 4, where we see that the contentment comes from, you know, when Paul says, I've learned to be content in every situation, whether prosperity or need or whatever it is. And he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That is the secret that he gives for his contentment. In other words, what the contentment means is that you can rest knowing that God will give you what you need to endure this situation, mm-hmm, for however long you're in it. You do it through his power. you're not despairing, you're not giving up, but you are saying, I know I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can go through anything. He's not going to leave me. That is the source of the contentment. And Greg, the distinction you make between working to change things, which is clearly advocated, and being content in every situation, I think both those things work together, because the way you become content is by knowing that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And the verse that came to mind for me was in 1 Corinthians 7:21, where it says, "Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it." In other words, being a slave has no bearing on your inheritance with Christ. Whether you're a slave or a free man or whatever it is, when you're in Christ, you are a full member of the family. You are not at a lower status in God's eyes at all. But then he says, and there's the contentment, right? Then he says, but if you are able also to become free, rather do that. So there we see both of those sides.
Right.
It is better to be free. It is better to do that if you can. But at the same time, you know that you are in Christ, and that's not your status as a slave will not affect that at all. Mm-hmm. You're not a lower status in God's eyes. So I think that's a good example of how those two things fit together. All right. That's it, Greg. We're out of time.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you, Joel and Matchless Sam. We really appreciate hearing from you. If you have a question, send it to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.